Hello and welcome to today's podcast. This is part two of our three-part series reviewing recent developments in fraud, waste, and abuse. My name is Devin Cohen. I'm a partner at Ropes & Gray's healthcare practice group, and my practice includes a broad range of regulatory and transactional matters with a focus strongly in insurance requirements and payer-provider alignment. With me today are Michael Lampert and Andrew O'Connor. Michael is a partner in our healthcare practice group, whose work centers around providing strategic, regulatory, and transactional advice to clients in all sectors of the healthcare industry. And Michael co-heads our Chamber's Band 1 ranked False Claims Act practice. Andrew helps lead the healthcare and life sciences industry group with Michael, co-heads our False Claims Act practice, and he focuses on high stakes litigation and investigations in the healthcare and life sciences space. This podcast is going to dig into clinical laboratory arrangements and specimen collection arrangements and their implications under the kickback statute, civil monetary penalties law, and advisory opinions issued by OHHS OIG in 2023. Finally, our third podcast is going to focus specifically on enforcement actions in this space over the last year. Now, let's jump in. OIG has historically issued quite a few of documents and other information on the topic of remuneration offered and paid by labs, stating its position that arrangements providing free or below market goods or services to actual or potential referral sources are suspect and may violate the kickback statute, and that arrangements providing greater than market value goods or services are similarly suspect, as through their implication that one purpose of the overpayment could be viewed to induce a referral. The government has repeatedly expressed concerns over these type of arrangements and, you know, really is starting to, I think, take a bit of a clear view on issues relating to overutilization and increased cost to federal healthcare programs and beneficiaries, as well as unfair competition.
Devin, just to chime in from an enforcement perspective, the area of labs has been a hot enforcement priority for the Department of Justice. I sit here in Boston, where the U.S. Attorney's Office, which has been active for a long time in the healthcare space, has been particularly focused on arrangements with labs, but it is something we see across the country. Just recently, the acting head of the Civil Division for DOJ announced at a conference that arrangements with labs and referrals will continue to be an area of enforcement focus for DOJ.
And so here's what OIG did here in 23. It was advisory opinion 2306, and it was issued to a pathology lab. So a lab that would perform both what's called the professional component of testing and the technical component. Technical component is prepare the slide to examine. Professional component is have a pathologist actually examine that slide, right? Use the microscope, see what's on it. So put the slide together, technical, use the slide, examine it through the microscope, professional component. And so this lab had a couple of sort of features to it. Feature one is it was in network with a bunch of insurers, right? That can be an issue, not so much an issue on the Medicare side, but it can be an issue on the commercial side, right? Is an insurer going to pay a lab, just like any healthcare provider, to provide the service? So it was in network. And it received a lot of specimens to examine from physician offices, some of which may have their own labs or partial labs, or at least be in a position to prepare specimens, certainly on tissues that have been taken from the patient. So docs in their labs would send material to this requester lab in order to perform the interpretations. So the proposal was that on the commercial side, where the requester lab was in network, it would bill insurers for the global service, that's to say for the technical component, prepare the slide, and for the professional component, interpret the slide. But all it would actually perform itself do would be that professional component, the interpretation using the smarts of its brilliant pathologists, right? It would buy essentially the slides pre-prepared from the physician offices. So doc would prepare the slide, send it to the lab. Lab would pay the doc for that slide and then would interpret it and would bill the insurer to get total reimbursement. The proposal recited that the lab had determined that the payments that it would make two physician offices would be at fair market value. It would be a per specimen fee at fair market value for purchasing, right, that technical component of the slide from the physicians who were referring the cases over. HHS-OIG gave a no, or at least it gave, as I said before, right, a not a green light. In the process of seeking an advisory opinion, HHS-OIG will tell the requester before the no comes out that this is going to be a no. And so there is the question, well, why keep going? Why not just take your answer and go home? I think an answer there is, as I had suggested before, to use it competitively, right? To communicate to the market, in this case, to the physicians who were seeking, expecting, asking for this payment, to say, no, sorry, folks, can't do it. And could also be to competitor labs that were making this payment to send them a signal, or to send the market a signal that what those competitor labs were doing was subject to enforcement scrutiny. So this is, as Devin had said, it's an area that isn't brand new at all for HHS-OIG. Back in 2005, there was a not green light, negative opinion issued to a lab around specimen collection arrangements, ordering physicians for specimens that they would prepare to send. In 2014, HHS-OIG issued a special fraud alert on kind of the same thing. In 2022, there was another opinion that HHS-OIG issued. It was another negative opinion, a not green light opinion, also around the payment for specimen collection. And so it comes in a pretty long line of, from HHS-OIG's perspective, of consistent guidance saying we do not support labs payments to organizations sending those labs slides, tissue specimens, whatever it might be, right, for the preparation of those specimens.
Yeah. And Michael, it's those per specimen arrangements that we saw OIG kind of continue to dig its heel in, right here with another advisory opinion on 2306, focusing on per specimen. Some of the important takeaways of this advisory opinion are how the requester or the arrangement was structured with efforts to mitigate risk of fraud and abuse, but according to the OIG, not effective to do so. And so some of the factors that the OIG saw here on a per specimen arrangement, really consistent with a number of past opinions, were first, the arrangements carving out federal healthcare business does not insulate it from posing a risk of fraud and abuse to Medicare, Medicaid, or TRICARE, et cetera, because physicians very often would like to use a single stop for all of their labs, despite the type of insurance that would be covered by the patients. This is very akin to the pull-through risk that we've seen discussed previously. Also in this arrangement, not surprisingly to see, it was not a green light, because the OIG found the financial terms weren't reasonable. And there also were unfair competition risks in that market, where there was a significant incentive they saw being paid under this arrangements to refer patients.
Devin, I agree with all that. Five quick takeaways I might offer. First, lab specimen collection arrangements are just subject to scrutiny. HHS-OIG, at least, has expressed continually negative views of them. Point two, just as you said, the federal carve-out wasn't enough. The relationship between the lab and the practices that would send it business is a relationship that goes beyond commercial. It includes both commercial volumes and federal healthcare program volumes. And so if there's a payment on just the commercial, right, you know, folks kind of get the view, well, it could affect the totality of that relationship, which would include, as you said, Devin, the pull-through of the Medicare business. Point three, fair market value. Not enough there, right? There was a recitation of fair market value in reg. HHS-OIG is not authorized to opine on fair market value, and so therefore needs to accept it, right, as a certification given. But it wasn't enough to save the arrangement. Point four, it is a good illustration of the difference between the protection available for formula-based compensation under the Stark Law, not relevant here, from the protection available under the kickback statute, relevant here, right? The safe harbor for personal services arrangements under the anti-kickback statute has been amended, right, to permit formula-based comp. But if the formula is volume variable, that's not saying the formula changes based on the volume, but if the formula itself associates or sort of incorporates the volume of referrals, that is not going to be, in HSOIG's view, eligible for protection under that safe harbor. So if you have a per specimen fee and it's just multiplied by the number of specimens, the aggregate amount of money is going to take into account the volume of referrals, and that's not protectable under the anti-kickback statute safe harbor, which is a different world, right, than the Stark personal services exception, which would protect arrangements with that type of variability baked into the formula, so long as the per click amount isn't changing. So it's a good illustration of that. And point five is actually the same as point one, but I just sort of underscore it, which is to say lab collection arrangements, payments for lab specimens by labs are just payments that HSOIG for a while has flagged as inconsistent with its view of the world, and payments therefore that face an uphill push.
Thanks, Michael. So, I mean, going forward, and others in the healthcare industry, they should be keeping in mind this OIG skepticism and disfavoring of arrangements, particularly when trying to identify new or unique revenue opportunities in the lab testing space, accounting the contours and the safeguards that OIG has been kind of laying out over its series of advisory opinions.
We focused, obviously, on advisory opinions. Those advisory opinions are the result not of HHSOAG's election of where to enforce, but instead the result of when people write in and say, hey, this is something we're thinking about. What do you say, agency, right? And they're significant, though, from a legal perspective, from an enforcement perspective, in my view, I think, because OIG does get sign-off from DOJ if it gives a favorable opinion. The view is that that favorable opinion offers essentially an immunity cloak. While the opinions don't technically bind DOJ, right? In each opinion, it says at the back, it binds only HHSOIG. From this lawyer's perspective, it would be difficult, I'd think, for the government to bring an action successfully, charging that a party acting in accordance with an advisory opinion was knowingly or intentionally violating the law. And so it would seem difficulty from a scienter perspective. But Andrew, what do you think?
I agree, Michael. You know, DOJ really ought to be less likely to pursue an action against an entity that's modeled their behavior on OIG guidance. After all, HHS, where OIG sits, is supposed to be DOJ's client in FCA cases. And certainly from a policy perspective, we would hope that they would be aligned one-to-one. That being said, as you pointed out, opinions are not formally binding on anybody but OIG and with respect to anyone other than the entity that requested that. So DOJ, with its 90-some U.S. attorney's offices and Maine Justice, which has its priorities, is certainly free in other circumstances to bring a False Claims Act case, even though we would certainly argue they would have an uphill battle. Second, I would add, maybe more importantly, that these advisory opinions are not binding on relators' counsel. Someone can file a False Claims Act case in the government's name, even if OIG is telling the world they wouldn't exercise their enforcement discretion in that same way. And so because we know that DOJ very rarely exercises its authority to intervene and dismiss a case out from under a relator, if you don't have an advisory opinion, or even if you do, there is still some risk that a private party could bring an FCA case on that same conduct. So OIG opinions, I agree, very important. But in our next podcast, we will frame up a number of other considerations in the enforcement space that folks in the healthcare world, whether they be manufacturers, providers, or other vendors, will want to consider as they look ahead to assess and minimize their risk in 2024.
Thank you all for joining us for our review on fraud, waste, and abuse trends and developments in this healthcare podcast series. For those of you listening who'd like more information on the topics discussed today, or our healthcare group more broadly, or our litigation enforcement team, please don't hesitate to contact us. Our next podcast will address trends we observed in enforcement actions, as Andrew just said, over the last year. And you can also remember to subscribe and listen to other Ropes and Gray podcasts wherever you regularly listen to your podcasts, including on Spotify and Apple. Thanks again for listening.